Welcome to Eastern Standard, a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced with the support of 1. The Alltech Ideas Conference and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and in case you haven't made her acquaintance, allow me to introduce you to Ivy Brashear. Ivy's a native of Viper, Kentucky, not far from Hazard. She's a 5th-generation Perry Countian, a 10th-generation Appalachian. She earned a bachelor's degree in journalism and Appalachian studies here at Eastern Kentucky University, and then got a master's in community and leadership development from UK. Ivy is a board member for the New Economy Coalition, a steering committee member of the Kentucky Rural Urban Exchange, a member of the Stay Together Appalachian Youth Project, the Young Climate Leaders Network, the Appalachian Food Summit, and Kentuckians for the Commonwealth. Ivy is the Appalachian Transition Coordinator at the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, or MACED, and her work for MACED focuses on shifting the narrative of Appalachia, and that's what we want to talk to her about. Thanks for stopping by Eastern Standard, Ivy.
Thanks for having me.
So with that resume, it's pretty hard to know where to begin, but I do want to focus on the work that you're doing at MACED, which is very much in line with what we want to do more of here on Eastern Standard. And that's to tell a new and a different story about Appalachian Kentucky. And you're calling your campaign Appalachia's New Day.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, the idea behind this is that Appalachia is experiencing a new economic day right now. We're trying to recreate a more just and sustainable economy in the region. We're trying to build new things that we have never done before, but also build upon what we've done always, like local foods and tourism and arts and culture and heritage. So the idea behind this campaign, Appalachia's New Day, is that we want to celebrate this new day that we're experiencing. And this new day comes after what a lot of people would say is a collapse of the coal industry in the region. And this industry, as lots of other people know, that it has kept the region afloat for a very long time, for 150 or more years. But now we're having to figure out what to do next. What do we do next? But as we at MACED know, and as many others in the region know, we have been reinventing ourselves in Eastern Kentucky over and over again for decades. So we're trying to, with this campaign, talk about those reinventions, talk about what we're doing now in the region. We're trying to allow local folks to tell their own stories about what they are doing, the work they're doing in their communities to create a new economy there. It looks different in every place. It looks different in every community. There's no one-size-fits-all solution. And we want to tell all of these stories, and we want to help amplify these stories through this campaign.
Is it fair to say that in the wake of coal's demise and the rise of a new and very educated generation, that there's kind of an alignment of stars going on here? Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. Yeah. You know, when the SOAR initiative started a few years ago, we had some very powerful people standing on a stage and talking about the end of coal and how we needed to move beyond that and do something else. And certainly in my lifetime, I'm almost 33, that's the first time I've ever heard influential leaders say that phrase, that we need to do something else. So I think that we are at a very critical moment right now where we have a lot of opportunity, actually, to explore what are we going to do? What does it look like in Eastern Kentucky to have an economy that works with the rest of the 21st century world?
And you mentioned the uniqueness of each community, a lot of very different things going on all around the region. There also has been in the past, there has been sort of a fiefdom attitude about our counties and a lack of collaboration and cooperation across those boundaries. Do you see those boundaries beginning to maybe blur a little bit? Can we look for some collaboration?
Absolutely. I see that happening between counties. I also see it happening between county seats and the rest of the county. That's also been sort of a line of division that's existed. But we're seeing things like in Letcher County, for instance, where there are lots of different people coming together. It's called the Letcher County Culture Hub, and they're trying to figure out what they want their community, their county seat of Wattsburg, what they want it to be, what they want to do there. They're talking about some really cool, interesting collaborations. But I'm also seeing it in other ways, too, across county lines. People are realizing that it's a lot smarter and it's a lot stronger and better to work together across those lines of arbitrary division, really, to do something better. There's another initiative. It's in a five-county region in eastern Kentucky around tourism, where these five counties came together and said, we need to have a website, which is a hub that talks about all the things that are available here for people to do. So I'm seeing a lot of that collaboration, a lot of that cross-county work happening.
I'm going to come back to tourism in just a minute, because I do think that that's a very important component of this. But I wanted to ask you, if you were to take inventory of the region to say, okay, let's gather together our strengths here, what would you say that would lead that list?
I would say the biggest strength that we have in eastern Kentucky is our people. The people in eastern Kentucky are committed and dedicated and rooted in this place. They are also, because of that, rooted in finding solutions that work for this place uniquely. You know, we are not seeing a lot of folks these days in the region wanting to do things that other places are doing. We're seeing folks thinking about, what have we always done here? What has always been important to us as a people in this place? And how can we use that to advance our economy forward into the future?
I think from a tourism standpoint, that level of authenticity is absolutely crucial. You don't go to visit someplace on your vacation to see something that you could see in your own home.
Right, exactly.
Is there anything on the public policy level that could be done, do you think, to help the region make this transition?
Definitely, definitely. There has been a push in recent years for a larger release of abandoned mine lands funds. This is called the Reclaim Act. It's at the national level. It has several co-sponsors. Hal Rogers is actually one of those co-sponsors, and he's sort of leading the effort to get this passed through Congress. This would allow for a lot more of that money to be released back to eastern Kentucky, as well as other parts of the country where coal mining and other kinds of mining have happened. This money would allow us to do a lot more economic development work. It would allow local people to be more involved in that work. So that's definitely one clear example of some public policy that needs to happen. On the state level, I would say there's a lot of stuff that could happen. If we could increase investment in infrastructure, for instance, there's a lot of infrastructure need in the region. Broadband is a big part of that, but also water lines need to be repaired and fixed. Roads and bridges need to be repaired and fixed. If we could get some money for that in the region, it could be a huge, huge boon to economic development.
And I've read that one of your interests is in the revival of main streets in many towns. Why is that important?
That's important because what happens on Main Street cannot be outsourced. That money that is generated in businesses on main streets, which are typically local, locally owned with local people working there, that money gets recycled into the local economy. It also creates a sense of identity for these communities that I feel like we've gotten a little bit away from as businesses have moved out of Main Street. They've moved to, you know, the edge of town onto these major highways that are coming through, four-lane highways. We've sort of been infiltrated with a lot of outside corporations and outside factories that have come in and just taken those jobs out of Main Street, out of the center of a community. And when you have a center of community like that, you also have a lot of what we call third spaces, which are places where people in the community can go and gather that aren't home and work. So it allows for a lot of that conversation to happen among a community that we're seeing a lot of divides between people and communities. And if we had these spaces where we could come together and just talk to one another, a lot of those divides could go away. It could help with further economic development, further revitalization of main streets and communities.
And I know you're also interested in using the medium of storytelling to advance the region. And what I'm about to say elicits a groan everywhere now. Do we have to talk about that again? Stereotypes? But that is a goal, isn't it, to move past those stereotypes and prove them wrong?
Yeah, definitely. In my master's thesis, did a lot of research about these stereotypes and these stories about the region. What I found was that for really 300 years, powerful people have been telling stories about this place, extracting these stories that oftentimes are inaccurate or at the very least not complete. And these stories have served to fuel powerful people and keep the agency of local people tamped down so that local people have felt like we don't have any options. We can't really do anything else. If we are able to reclaim our own stories, tell our own stories, we'll be able to reclaim some of that agency and some of our decision-making power around what happens in our communities. We'll be able to give consent one way or another about what we want to happen in our places.
Well, we would like to invite you to bring these stories to WEKU and to Eastern Standard. This is, after all, Eastern Kentucky University. And we ask you to feel free to use our 50,000 watts and our 9 additional transmitters and repeaters that are all around the region to share these narratives. And we hope you'll make yourself a frequent visitor.
Well, we will be glad to do that.
Ivy Brashear, Appalachian Transition Coordinator at MACED, the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development. Thanks so much, Ivy.
Thank you.
Up next, what are we doing to our kids here in Kentucky? And later, the consequences of draining coal severance funds. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by 1. The All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as transformative opportunity for their business and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through the 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at 1.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
National rates of child abuse have in recent years stabilized. They've even declined in some places. Yet Kentucky now has the highest rate of child abuse in the United States. It's detailed in the report Child Mistreatment 2017, the latest year analyzed by the Children's Bureau of the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. Kentucky reported more than 22,000 victims. That's more than 2,000 from the year before and more than double the national average. What's going on here? Dr. Myra Beth Bundy is professor of clinical psychology here at EKU, and she joins us to sort through this latest report and talk about the implications. Greetings, Dr. Bundy.
Thank you for having me.
Now, when you see these statistics and hear these numbers, what goes through your mind?
Well, it's just a major concern because the future of our state, our country, our world is in children. And as a psychologist, and really as a layperson too, we know that the experiences that people have in childhood are important learning opportunities and determine how they'll behave and live the rest of their lives.
And how do these numbers that I've stated here, how do they break down for Kentucky?
When we look at the Child Welfare League of Kentucky, the Child Welfare League of America's Kentucky's Children 2018 report, what we see is that it looks at different types of child maltreatment. This report says that 93.4% of the reports for children who were neglected, 7.8% were physically abused, and 3.9% were sexually abused.
Any theories on why Kentuckians are abusing our children more than people in any other state in the country?
I'm sure it's a complex set of factors. I talked with a person that I know who is a social worker in this state and said, what do you think? You're on the ground floor of this. What's your experience? And she talked about the opioid crisis in this state, and how that affects individuals, families, and parenting behaviors, ability to parent. She talked about the lack of resources available in the rural parts of Kentucky to assist families who are having intense needs. And then she talked about overburdened resources in the state in general. Some of the specific things she talked about are long waits for rehab beds or other kinds of rehab treatment for people that are having drug and alcohol challenges, waiting lists for classes of all kinds, including parenting classes, child development, knowledge kinds of classes, waiting lists for assessments for children or families that may need help in general. When you look at urban versus rural areas in the state, there's more need and fewer resources in the rural areas.
Is child abuse most prevalent at a particular socioeconomic level, in a particular kind of family, or by race or ethnicity, or does it know no bounds?
Child abuse can occur anywhere, in any kind of family, but having more stressors than resources does put families at heightened risk. When we think about child abuse and what child abuse is, we can look at the parent-child relationship between that dyad. We can look at learning history of an individual in their family and in their cultural, what kind of behaviors have been modeled and reinforced. And we should also look at the context surrounding the family and the parent-child pair.
It seems as though we often talk about child abuse in fairly clinical or forensic or statistical terms, the numbers, the accepted causes, and so on. But you're a parent of six. I'm a parent of six kids. I can't get past the sheer, too often monstrous cruelty that would drive an adult to mistreat a child in these ways. So should I assume that we're talking here about a mental illness on the part of the abuser?
Certain factors can certainly put parents at heightened risks for maltreating, including substance abuse problems, as we've talked about, and also mental illness. But in general, I think that we tend to think too much that there's a dichotomy between a normal parent and an abusive parent. And I think that dichotomy is a lot less clear than we think. It's probably more than likely a complex set of factors, sort of a chronic escalating problem in behavior, problem in relationship that ends up culminating in repeated patterns of abuse, not just one incident, but repeated patterns.
We talk about the bond between parent and child, and a big component of that is trust. What does abuse do to a person's ability to trust?
Absolutely. It severely compromises the child's ability to attach to their caregiver, to other people, to trust the world, to trust all of the people that they have to interact with for the rest of their life. Teachers, future romantic partners, colleagues. I actually brought this to show you, Tom. It's Erik Erikson is a psychologist who has this theory of psychosocial development. And you can see his first stage here is trust versus mistrust for babies and young toddlers. And then autonomy versus shame, initiative versus guilt. All these sort of foundational personal developments relate to and sort of rest on the foundation of trust.
Do children who are abused, do they tend to become adults who abuse?
They can be at a higher risk for this because all of us as humans learn from what we see, learn from what we model, and learn from what we're rewarded for. So if they see abuse and experience abuse, they may be at a heightened risk to engage in those kind of behaviors themselves. Most of us have learned our parenting behaviors from the parenting experiences we had in our own homes growing up.
A moment ago, you talked about resources being stretched thin, and I'm wondering if social and child protection workers who are out there on the front lines of child abuse, is something happening that's impacting their abilities to be effective?
Absolutely. Going back to this article that I talked about earlier, this publication, the Child Welfare League of America's report for Kentucky. Well, in general, this organization recommends a 12 to 15 caseload, ideally, for a child welfare worker or a foster care worker. And in Kentucky, that load ranges between 25 to 32 or even a little bit higher. So the burden is high. And we've had some things go on with our state pension system that is placing benefits at risk for these caseworkers as well.
Is it true that in Kentucky, if you even suspect that a child is being abused, that you are required by law to report that?
That's right. All citizens in Kentucky are mandated reporters.
And so who best to report it to?
You can report to the Child Protection Hotline, and you can just Google or search for that, and it comes up really quickly. There's also an online reporting option.
Okay, I'm going to put that information on our facts and information page at esweku.com. If you're able to write it down, one number you can call is 877-597-2331. Do you have any thoughts, Dr. Bundy, on how a past victim of these kinds of horrendous experiences can grow up to become somebody who's empowered and strong?
I'm so glad you asked. You're talking about an area of the literature that we call resilience, studying resilience, fostering resilience, all kinds of complex research about it. But just in short, having a positive relationship with an adult, any adult, is a protective factor. Being intelligent or having other positive personality or temperament characteristics, and just receiving support in as many life areas as possible.
Dr. Myra Beth Bundy is a professor of clinical psychology here at Eastern Kentucky University. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Young people with no place to call home. There are thousands in this situation across Kentucky, more than 25,000 according to the state. And here to bring it closer to home are Donna Daniels, director of the Brushy Fork Institute, and associate director Troy Price. They, along with Partners for Education at Berea College, recently held a summit on youth homelessness. We thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Donna, if you would first give us a little background on the Brushy Fork Institute about its mission.
Certainly. Well, Brushy Fork Institute is a strategic initiative of Berea College, and folks may wonder why Berea College would be sponsoring a youth homelessness summit. It really connects very closely with the commitments that Berea has in terms of its service to the region as well as its service to the students. So the college has 8 great commitments. And the college also admits only academically promising students with limited financial resources, primarily students from Kentucky and Appalachia. And so if you're talking about serving homeless youth or trying to identify who homeless youth are, that aligns with that commitment, certainly. But the other commitment that Brushy Fork falls under is a commitment to serve the communities and families of the region as well. So Brushy Fork's mission is partnering with communities to develop and support leadership efforts that are around issues that are important to the people who live in Appalachian communities. And that's why we did this summit.
Okay, and just for our orientation, our listeners' orientation, what we're going to focus on in this interview is the 8-county region known as the Kentucky Promise Zone. Could you bring everybody up to speed on what exactly that is?
Sure. The Promise Zone is a federally designated area that's made up of 8 counties, and those counties are Bell, Clay, Harlan, Knox, Leslie, Letcher, Perry, and then 6 of the 8 census tracts in Whitley County. And that's a 10-year designation, and it allows for extra credit priority points for certain federal funding streams that are coming into that region. So it's not a funded initiative per se, but those communities and those counties get a little extra boost if they apply for some federal funding sources.
Okay. Troy Price, you have some data that was gathered from a survey of youth done by Partners for Education at Berea College. What's been learned?
As part of that, on March 26th, the Promise Zone Youth Homelessness Summit, we wanted to give them a snapshot of homelessness in the area. The first part of the day was looking at homelessness and what it feels like, what it sounds like. We wanted to raise the voice of, you know, those that were experiencing homelessness. Then in the afternoon, we kind of shifted gears, and it was the folks that were actually doing the work, and they made plans for after the summit. So it was a great day. What I did at the very beginning was share some statistics with the folks that were there, and I'd love to talk about really what it looked like on there. We being our colleagues at the Partners for Education, they disseminated surveys and got back 6,250 surveys.
Wow.
For housing in just those counties. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty well disseminated that, you know, we got back so many. And the interesting things, it's one question that was on that. The question being, has there been a time in your life when you didn't know where you were going to sleep, in essence? You know, were you home insecure would be the definition, you know, when we talk about mm-hmm. it in the homelessness mm-hmm. Sector. And 11% of those said yes. So that means of those that were surveyed, about 700 children would say yes. if we extrapolate that to the whole population, that would be about 7,000 kids themselves in the Promise Zone. So to put some context into that, if they were all in one place, they would almost completely fill up, you know, the Alumni Coliseum here on EKU's campus, or the East Kentucky Expo Center in Pikeville. It would completely fill that up. But they rare, you know, there's no occasion where everybody is going to be together. Unfortunately, they suffer alone. It's just an evening where they don't know where they're going to be, or when the household that they've known their whole lives is shaken for various reasons we'll talk about in a second. So that's the experience that they have, and it's 11%, you know, of the population.
And are these kids across the age range of what we consider youth, from very, very young children to older teens?
Sure. It could be, children very young. Some of the definitions actually go up to age 24, you know, and that's, a federal definition as well. Mm-hmm. So looking at that population, that is anywhere from birth to age 24. There's some other questions from that survey that were particularly powerful. Of that 11% looked in and said, well, when was the last time where you did feel safe in your home? And if you would imagine a pie that's been cut in half, and then one of the halves cut into three pieces of pie, one of the third halves would be the ones that have said, you know, it was just, you know, within the past month when I was really safe. It's just something right now. The half of the pie is actually for the youth that said, I've not been safe in over a year. So this is a chronic situation for them. Of those, you know, extrapolated out 7,000 folks, something that's happened, you know, for over a year.
That's a long, long time. And the first thing that comes to my mind is conditioning, the impact, the psychological effect that's having on a child, especially to go that long in that kind of situation.
Yes. And exactly connected to your question there, one of the questions we asked is, do you have an adult that you could talk to? Do you feel safe? When we looked at everybody that responded, the 6,000, over 80% said, yes, there's somebody that I can talk to that I would feel comfortable with. When we look at that subpopulation of those that didn't know, you know, where they were going to sleep at a night, it was under 70. So there's a big swing of those that they don't know where they're going to sleep. They've got other issues that we'll talk about in a second. And who can they talk to? Well, more of them don't know.
On the national level, the numbers I'm seeing, the lack of affordable housing is cited as one of the biggest factors contributing to homelessness in general. According to the National Low Income Housing Coalition, a family with a full-time worker making minimum wage cannot afford fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment anywhere in the U.S. today, which is incredible. Is the Kentucky situation a reflection of what's being seen across the country, or do we have additional issues such as drug addiction?
Imagine that pie again, and imagine a pie that's been cut into six pieces. Okay, so that's something that I imagine every day. The first piece that would be in the upper right-hand corner, that is not economics. The largest was if drugs and alcohol were in the home. They say that's the significant issue. The second piece of the pie would be violence in the home. The third is economics, that they cite that. Below that is when we also get into substandard housing, those kinds of things. But they don't reference economics being the issue. They reference drug and alcohol and violence being in the home.
And again, I think it's important to emphasize that we're talking about this cohort is from that 8-county region here in Kentucky. These are not national stats.
Correct. And it's 2018. So this is, you know, hot off the presses stuff.
Okay. What about school? Do these kids get help with the day-to-day things like making sure they're getting their homework done, making sure they go to school in clean clothes? What about their social lives, which can be so important for a child?
One of the things that we heard about at the Youth Homelessness Summit from the school systems is that some of the school systems actually have homelessness liaisons that work with the Family Resource Center and Youth Service Center, the Friskies, they call them, in the school systems. And so the schools are working hard, I think, to serve students through that. And then you also have community action agencies like the Kentucky Communities Economic Opportunity Council that are working to connect students with resources and to provide shelter when students need shelter, to provide transportation if they need transportation to go to things like a food stamp office if they need to secure, have food security and things like that. But, you know, it's not an effort that's just within the school system. It's actually a broader community effort that's happening in those communities.
You mentioned earlier that that you all recently participated, along with Partners for Education and the Kentucky Communities Economic Opportunities Council, in a Promise Zone Youth Homelessness Summit. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit more about what was learned and what were some outcomes from that gathering.
Donna's looked at that most recently.
I have looked at that most recently. And so we really focused this summit on the coordinated community plan to prevent and end youth homelessness. And, you know, you may wonder what that is. And that is a plan that comes out of the Kentucky Housing Corporation. They did a youth homelessness demonstration program that was funded by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and was overseen by Kentucky Housing Corporation. And so in the Youth Homelessness Summit, we tried to work with some of the focus areas that they had identified in that plan. And there were four specific areas that we looked at. One was how do communities identify youth who are homeless or at risk of homelessness? So that was one area. The other was how can communities support providing stable housing for homeless youth? Because as you pointed out, that stable housing is the foundational piece that causes homelessness. So how do we get them into stable housing? How do we provide education and employment opportunities that will support those young people, with the result that the young people will eventually have the ability to get a stable job that will allow them to be in stable housing? And how can communities create connections to support the social and emotional well-being of homeless youth, which, again, you've referenced earlier that there are needs for those students. So the communities are aware of these issues and are looking at ways to address them. So they spent the day, they spent the morning actually in some learning sessions with some resource folks that talked about statistics, talked about approaches and those types of things. And then they spent the afternoon talking about, okay, what actions can we take in our communities across the board in the Promise Zone to address some of these issues?
You all and Dreema Gentry at Partners and the folks at the Communities Economic Opportunities Council, you're kind of sort of on the front lines of this. The rest of us are not necessarily. We're going through our day-to-day and doing our thing and being concerned about our business. But tell me why we should become more connected with this problem and what kind of difference we could make in this situation.
Well, speak to that in terms of the solutions that the communities came up with,
okay,
because those solutions really, they put some thought into how people across the board in the community can be engaged in it. And so if we think about the identifying youth who are homeless or at risk of homelessness, those young people are not always easy to identify. They're not often found in the same places that you might find adult homeless people. You know, those folks may be in tents somewhere. Those are the kind of typical vision that we have for homeless people, or they may be found in shelters. Homeless youth many times are couch surfing or doubling up with other people in housing. And they may also be really embarrassed by the stigma of homelessness or even afraid that there are going to be consequences that are beyond their control if they admit to somebody that they're homeless. And so the folks around that, they discussed educating people in the community, helping them understand, first of all, that there's not a stigma related to homelessness, that it can happen to anybody, that they are educating school staff about what youth homelessness might look like if they see a student going home with different people every day or recognize that the student's wearing the same clothes to school every day or doesn't look like they're bathing, that kind of thing. They discussed holding public awareness events to educate the general public, again, about that stigma, to remove the stigma associated with homelessness. And also setting up community-wide resource guides that if anybody in the community recognizes that a student or a young person may be homeless or at risk of homelessness, then they know where to send that young person for help. The faith-based community was one of the areas that they really engaged in thinking about this work in those Promise Zone counties, because there is such a strong movement for community efforts through the faith-based community.
Is there anything that we haven't touched on here that you wanted to make sure that we covered?
I think that if this is an issue that is ringing true with the listener, there are loads of ways that they can get connected with people that are serving the homeless population now. And a little volunteerism or a little, you know, donation really goes a long way with this problem, with this particular population. So what I would suggest is, as what we mentioned before, contact the Family Youth Service or Youth Service Center in their schools. Mm-hmm. They could contact the health department. The folks at the health department may have had a large attendance at the summit. Mm-hmm. They can contact Child Protective Services or Juvenile Justice Services. There's also, it's a national organization called Point Source Youth, and they have a particular wing on just rural youth. So if you just get on the internet to search for Point Source Youth, they would be a resource as well. And there's contacts all around, you know, in the area in Hazard and Corbin, you know, and down in Harlan as well, that find somebody that's doing the work already and just ask to be involved.
Very good. And Donna, any closing thoughts?
Well, and building on what Troy just said, I think in terms of that supporting the social and emotional well-being of homeless youth, that the relationships in community are really important to bringing these young people into the community and helping them navigate some of those everyday challenges that life might throw at us. If we need to figure out how to open a checking account, or what do we do if we have a flat tire on a car, if you're someone that needs to have food stamps, how do you apply for those food stamps? Having relationships and mentorship in communities to help young people deal with those types of actions or activities and things they need to do is as important as the money that people can give sometimes. And so that's an important piece in this. And I would also suggest that if folks want to learn more about rural homelessness and rural youth homelessness, that they contact Shay Raybould at the Kentucky Housing Corporation for more information. Their website is kyhousing.org, and she can tell you more about that regional plan and really about homelessness in general throughout Kentucky. So,
all right. Donna Daniels, Director, Troy Price, Associate Director of the Brushy Fork Institute. It's great work that you all are doing, and thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In a moment.
When you're already stripped down to the bone and then you see another hit in a lot of these places, it's not only cutting investment in economic development and infrastructure, but you're also cutting down to bare bone services, whether it's waste management or law enforcement.
Reporter Mason Adams on his article in Southerly Magazine detailing the consequences of drawing down coal severance funds that were meant to help eastern Kentucky counties make the transition from a coal-based economy. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference. One is an incubator of innovation, a forum for future thinkers, and a platform for propelling forward the promise of a planet of plenty. Attendees view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives in order to make a difference in the world. Learn more about 119 in Lexington, May 19th through 21st, 2019, at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the number of mining and logging jobs in Kentucky fell by 69% between 1989 and 2019. And along with this devastating blow to work in the coal fields has come a steady decline in revenues from the coal severance tax. Less coal coming out of the ground means a sharp decline in this tax that is split between state and county governments. And now, county governments in Appalachian Kentucky, and by close extension, the people they serve, are hurting. Mason Adams has done some comprehensive reporting on this situation and its consequences for an article now appearing in the online magazine Southerly. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Mason.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And let's begin with how important coal severance tax revenues have been to the well-being of coal field counties. What kinds of things have these revenues paid for?
So they're supposed to pay for the economic future of Kentucky after coal. These severance taxes were supposed to be set aside for economic development projects and for other types of initiatives that would set up these coal counties for a future after coal. But as we've seen, I mean, I think it's human nature. A lot of counties have started to cut into those taxes just to cover their basic operating expenses. Mm-hmm. And especially as coal has declined, severance taxes have declined, but so have their other sources of revenue. Per pupil funding for education has gone down. The state reassessed its unmined mineral tax in the middle of a school year to boot, which saw a severe drop in a lot of counties after they had already sort of budgeted for the year. And even property taxes are going down as some of these counties have become depopulated. So some of them have relied more and more on coal severance tax to prop up their operating revenue streams, which is not the way they were intended to be set up, but that's kind of the way they've been used in more than one county.
And these revenues are split between state and county governments. And I do recall that there have been times when the state legislature has dipped into the coal severance fund. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's right. A chunk of the statewide coal severance tax revenue goes towards state operations. If you look at the state's website for this revenue source, there's actually a flow chart that they have, and there's arrows going everywhere with some money coming off the top, some coming out the middle. So hypothetically, counties get 50% of this revenue stream, but when you actually look at how it's broke down, that's not quite the case. There's arrows going all over the place on this. And that's, I think, one of the criticisms of the way that Kentucky does its coal severance tax by some policy folks is it's too complicated and doesn't return enough money to where it's supposed to be going.
You write in your article that the decline in these revenues has exposed some things like low-level corruption or bad management and has had some serious consequences for people in the region. And let's begin with what's been exposed.
Right. Well, you know, Mary Cromer, a lawyer with the Appalachian Citizens Law Center, summed it up by saying, you know, you can have low-level corruption and bad management and things go along fine as long as you have coal severance money coming in to right the ship. So right off the bat, we're looking at Martin County, Kentucky, where the sheriff, that was sort of the precipitating incident that got us looking real closely at the story, was the sheriff took to Facebook basically to say that his staff didn't have the money to do real law enforcement anymore. They were cutting their hours and basically asking the state police to come in. Now, it wasn't just because of the coal severance tax, but also there had been some, you know, I think as with many counties, there's politics involved and, you know, disagreements between the different branches. Money isn't always going to where it's supposed to be going in a timely fashion. But beyond that, when I started digging into this story, just to make sure I had the math right, I made a spreadsheet of both the coal severance tax decline, but I also started looking at whether the judge executives were still there from several years ago, I guess from 2012 to 2018. And not only had there been a lot of turnover, but there were corruption charges, audits of that claimed bungled finances, in a number of states. I mean, so Mary Cromer's point is that I think some of these counties had basically been doing things ineptly at best, to be generous, and the coal severance money coming in kind of helped fill the gap on that and cover that up. But when these revenues started going down, you can make errors to a certain degree when there's a lot of money coming in, but when you start losing revenues and your budgets are getting pretty stripped, there's no room for error. And a lot of these county governments were having all sorts of issues that range by county, but there's a lot of them.
And that this decline in coal severance tax revenues has come on top of losses in other areas, right? Property taxes, for example?
Right. I mean, with more people moving out, and not only that, but some of it is directly linked to coal companies. You know, a lot of these companies were taxed based on equipment that they had sitting in the county. But as they've shut down their operations and taken that out, that source of revenue has declined. Not to mention, you know, when you have loss of jobs in an area and unemployment has been, I guess I shouldn't say unemployment's been going up in the aggregate because I guess it's been going down, but some areas are still struggling with economic distress. And you know, in an economically distressed area that's losing population, your property taxes are going to decline, or at least not grow on pace with everyone around you, and certainly not with the services that residents want and need. I mean, at some point, some people made the point in the reporting that, you know, you can have fewer people, but the sheriff's office still has to patrol the same mileage of roads. Mm-hmm. There's a certain base level of service that are required, and below that, you can't cut anymore. You can't just keep cutting. Another issue that Southerly, I think, has covered very well, and that's aging infrastructure. You know, when we're talking about water lines that need replaced or wastewater treatment plants, some of these counties, like Martin County, for example, have had some issues with their drinking water. And so you're already having trouble with operating expenses. To think about a big capital investment like that is even more complicated, and that gets to the revenue issues as well.
You touched a moment ago on judge executives, and there have been some pretty heavy political consequences to all this. Tell us about that.
Well, that was one of the things I looked at in my spreadsheet. So Angie Hatton, who's a delegate from Eastern Kentucky, suggested that there had been some political consequences. You know, when services are getting cut, people get upset, and a lot of times they blame the person in charge, which in a lot of these counties is the judge executive. And so there's been a lot of turnover. I think some of that is probably normal election cycle churn, but certainly there was a lot of turnover in these coal-producing counties that collect coal severance taxes. Out of 29 counties that received local assistance funds from the coal severance tax, 17 elected new judge executives in 2019.
Now, you quote one source in your article as noting that the coal severance shortfall represents a tipping point in a cycle afflicting rural central Appalachian communities. What did she mean by that?
So that was Pam Thomas, a senior fellow with the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. And Pam's also notable because she worked on the finance committee in the Kentucky State Legislature for many years before she became a fellow. And, you know, she said this is a perfect storm when it comes to revenue. Population is declining. And as she said, you know, and I said earlier, when you lose people, you can't necessarily cut all your expenses. If you're sheriff, you have to patrol the whole county. There's a lot of different pieces coming in to this problem for these counties, you know, with depopulation. And it's not just the decline of the coal industry, too. You know, in a lot of areas, it's you know, there's not great access to interstates, and the roads take maintenance money as well. So you already have economic distress and some decline that's been going on for, you know, decades in a couple of cases. So this decline in coal severance, which has dropped off pretty rapidly, it cycles up and down with the coal market to some degree. But in some places, it's just not coming back. And there were certainly examples of counties I looked at that received coal severance money in 2008, but did not in 2018. And so when you're already stripped down to the bone, and then you see another hit in a lot of these places, it's not only cutting investment in economic development and infrastructure, but you're also cutting down to bare bone services, whether it's waste management or law enforcement.
The scenario that we've been talking about here gives new definition to the word devastating. It certainly has been that for the region. The flip side that I'm seeing, and I wonder if you're seeing, is that a lot of smart people are beginning to step up with their ideas for ways out of this, solutions that turn the region in a new direction. Are you seeing any of that?
Sure. Although I think a lot of times when I see these solution stories, they're sort of positing as a way to save these communities. Mm-hmm. I really think that's the wrong lens to look at it, because no one thing is going to quote unquote save these communities. And I think time and again, where we have seen real successes, it's been from a tipping point in the other direction. Enough positive things stack up to sort of change the inherent perception of people who live in the area. So a lot of it is really coming from within the people who live in the area. And, you know, there's certainly elements from coming outside, but a lot of it has to do with what the people who live in a place think about it and its future. And, you know, so one thing by itself is not going to work. I've talked a few times to MACED, the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, who says there's no silver bullet, but a lot of silver BBs. Mm-hmm. And that makes a lot of sense to me, because in places where we have seen economic turnaround and reinvention, it's not been one single factor, but a lot of little things that work together. And usually, you know, there is a tipping point where the people start to believe that they have a new future ahead of them. And that sort of spirals and seems to really change the course of a community's future.
Mason Adams, a reporter based in Floyd County, Virginia, writes for Southerly Magazine online at southerlymag.org. And we posted a link to this article on our site, esweku.com. And thanks so much, Mason. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom. It was my pleasure.
Next week, we'll have a conversation with Dreema Gentry. She heads Partners for Education at Berea College, and we talk about the tension in the region. For many, a difficult place to live, but for many others, a place of possibility.
I think we have to own our data, and our data does show that this is, you know, like you said, one of the most difficult places to live when you think about those outcomes and those indicators. And that's systems-level data that we have to work to change. But I think we also, it's the bright spots, or what we call them. There are things happening throughout Appalachia. There are leaders, young leaders, that are really doing great work. And we see pockets of places where they have shifted those data points. And to me, it's understanding that on the large level, the data still is what it is, but that the work is happening at the local level. And how do we also look at the bright spots and start replicating and scaling those up?
And change is happening. One of their many projects is the Promise Neighborhood, which has made a big difference in Owsley, Clay, and Jackson counties.
When we started, 27% of the young people were proficient in math. By 2016, it was at 40%.
Dreema Gentry of Partners for Education joining us on next week's edition. And here's something you might want to experience if you'll be in downtown Lexington on the morning of Tuesday, April 23rd.
It's the light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine. This the light of mine.
The Harstad Fine Arts Series is presenting the Plantation Singers at Cheapside Park at 11 a.m. on the 23rd. This celebrated group represents Gullah culture on the Sea Islands of South Carolina and Georgia, communities of people who are the descendants of slaves directly linked to West Africa. They incorporate the arts of storytelling, song, and sweetgrass basket weaving. That's in Lexington's Cheapside Park at 11 a.m. on the 23rd. That's this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of 1. The All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. Information about Eastern Standard content partnerships can be found online at esweku.com. And now you can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app, available for Apple and Android devices. Eastern Standard is also available as a podcast. You'll find us on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thank you for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.